Hello, and welcome to Living Vertical Radio, where we change the narrative of media by introducing you to creative and innovative individuals that inspire you with their unique stories. Our host is Seesteen Duckworth. Please make sure your surrounding area is quiet because this is a live program. One Sure Sign Mobile Notary of Frisco, Texas provides professional notary service across the Dallas metro area. Our notary professionals are ready to help you with loan closings, power of attorney, fingerprinting, and other notary services. We meet you at your location of choice, your home, office, hospital, or local coffee shop, convenient to your schedule. Reliable, professional, and affordable. One Sure Sign is happy to support Living Vertical Radio here in Texas. Mention you heard this ad on Living Vertical for $5 off any notary service. Interested in advertising on our podcast with a listening audience of over 800,000? You can do a 15-second business ad, a 30-second radio ad, or a 10-minute interview radio ad. Our prices start out at $50. Contact us at info@verticalmediagroup.com. Our pricing is made to give everyone the ability to advertising no matter the budget. Thank you. And here's your host, Seesteen Duckworth.
Hello, everybody, and hope everyone's having a great Saturday. And today, we are just happy to have a new author to present to you. It's Jonathan Pruitt. And let me tell you a little bit about Jonathan. Jonathan is a lifelong educator, a former scientific researcher, and a provocative fantasy author. With his debut novel, The Amber Mimir, Pruitt delivers biting humor, deep human insights, and a unique scientist perspective. His life experiences from living in diverse corners of the world, like Southwest Africa, Namibia, Australia, and Canada, to navigating the wild landscape of his career, richly inform his narrative. Pruitt's storytelling defies reality yet resonates with emotional truth. He makes readers question the differences between good and evil and the murky area between the two. We'd like to welcome Jonathan and talk to him about his inspiration for his book, The Amber Mimir. So excited to have you on our program today. I'm a sci-fi fantasy person, so mm-hmm. I'm into your book already. I'm not finished with it, but I'm into it, definitely into it. So tell me what your inspiration was for writing The Amber Mimir.
I guess my whole life I've been in school. So, you know, for the first 35 years of my life, I went to school like normal people, and then I went to college, and then went on to grad school, and then started teaching at universities. And basically, I spent the first 35 years of my life in school. And, you know, as a young person, you know, the first sorts of books that I ever was interested in digesting were fantasy books. And so, you know, growing up on the fare of like Lord of the Rings or A Wheel of Time, you know, ever since I was a child, I was interested in writing a fantasy novel. And then because all I've ever known is school, I sort of thought, you know, it'd be neat one day to write a dark fantasy series set in an academic setting, because, you know, that's the world that I'm most familiar with. And so, you know, because I have been steeped in academic culture for, you know, a couple of decades now, I thought, you know, I should probably leverage that and try to make something that's reflective of our world, but sort of demonized and turned inside out. And so I came up with this concept mm-hmm. of like a set of magical schools that have exploited the larger masses, and that they're, you know, not familiar to fantasy and sci-fi books. There's a class system. There are people who can wield magic in various ways, and then the broader population that mm-hmm. cannot. And so these schools that teach and foster magical aptitudes have basically convinced the world, correctly or not, that it is in danger, and that the only way to save mm-hmm. it is through possible new kinds of magic that have not yet been discovered, but they might be one day. But the problem is that you know, figuring out new kinds of magic isn't easy, and it isn't cheap. And so you get this sort of like this intellectual vampiric elite that emerges. And in some ways, it's making fun of like, you know, like common criticisms of academia in our world. But on the other hand, it's also like tongue in cheek and meant to be playful. So I thought, you know, it'd be a neat setting. And then from there, I tried to devise a couple of storylines. The Amber Mineer is the first book that came out, that has just come out. And then there will be a couple of others at least that are in draft. And, you know, I was just mixing what I know and what I've always loved together was the recipe, I suppose, for the Amber Mineer.
So, I mean, how do you come to the thought that this is going to be a series rather than one novel?
Well, I mean, like many unwitting new fantasy or sci-fi lovers who think about writing a fantasy series or a sci-fi series, you know, we're going to write a trilogy. And, you know, and I think the intent to write a trilogy, at least in my mind, typically goes one of two ways. Either one, you realize how incredibly onerous writing one book is, and landing the plane and having a convincing story arc and having scenes that make sense and have a point and have tension, you know, and all the things that make sense as a reader that you need to do in each scene. But as a writer, sometimes you're like, oh, how do I get this character to this spot? And like, how do I get them motivated? And like, what exactly is going on? And how do I get to this next plot point that I need to get to? You know, that just is so overwhelming that many trilogies, you know, it's an armchair plan, end up becoming a single book or no book at all once someone gets steeped into writing it. Or what happened to me was, and this happens to many authors as well, you think, okay, I'm gonna make a trilogy, and I began to outline the set of problems I was providing the main characters, the sort of the dragon they have to slay, although they're no little dragons, but you know, the figurative dragon they have to slay. Mm-hmm. And it just becomes so unwieldy that I was like, oh my God, if I don't want to like, you know, have a Game of Thrones type ending, like the TV show variant, then I have to give myself an extra book or two. And so, but you know, like the last two books are written, and that's the last 40% of the series, there's five intended, are written with the entire goal of landing the plane and doing it with justice to make sure that every major character that people could possibly get emotionally attached to have, if not a happy ending, an ending with enough gravity and meaning that it should be satisfying, or I hope it will be satisfying.
Okay. So let's talk about world building, because that's what I see that you've done in the book. And I just want to say, because, you know, world building is an interesting thing, you know, when you're talking about writing. And for me, I'll just use a baseline for myself. My dad loves Star Trek. But I remember reading about Gene Roddenberry, how he really had done more than just, you know, write a script. I mean, he wrote the languages and, you know, it was interesting how he, got his cast. You know, it was more than just, oh, I want, you know, Mr. Spock. It was like, oh, he looks like Mr. Spock, you know. And so it was really, you know, interesting, because that's kind of what I liken to, you know, listening to some of your interviews and going to the book is like, oh, okay, well, this is something I can relate to, really, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did you start with your own world building?
Yeah, you know, okay, so first of all, I'm a nerd. I'm as big of a nerd as you could possibly be in sci-fi and fantasy. And, you know, and so like, I'm not dogging anybody who's in love with world building, because I love world building as much as anybody else. And I love those like very deep and very broad and very specific, almost encyclopedic tomes that describe the worlds where some of these great fantasies and sci-fi fairy tales and tales take place. Okay. So one, having a strong concept of what your world is like, what the rules are, what, you know, if you have magic, like, what does it do? What can it do? What can it not do? If you have robots, what are their rules? How do they live? And how do those, you know, what's going on there? And making sure that you, once you make those rules for your world, how many gods are there? What can they do? What can they not do? What, you know, species are there of humanoid entities wandering around? Just, you know, create the world and then stand by them. And when you do that, make sure that you are being careful about making sure that you don't accidentally design a world and a set of problems that you can't solve yourself. Because, you know, that, like, that could happen to you. But I will say, when you're writing your book, even if you have that amazing world building, this is where I say world building is dangerous, especially when you're first writing a fantasy book or a sci-fi book. Do not share all of your world immediately. You can't.
Okay.
You cannot tell people about the evolutionary ecology of this weird living forest and the lizards and butterflies that live in it and the little hamlet next to it and the genealogy of families ABC and the weird, like, you know, hand talk or, you know, vernacular or whatever that they each have. The populations, you can't waterboard the reader like that. So, you know, you should say, okay, here's how big my world is, but you have to start off with something small, an individual family, an individual house, an individual problem, you know, a relationship maybe, and start from there and just say, okay, I'm going to develop this problem, and I'm going to give the important parts of this world for this problem now. And then later on, as the problem gets larger or the, you know, how much of the world the characters see grows, then you seed modest amounts of world building along with the storyline as it expands. Because, you know, if you have many paragraphs or even just a couple of paragraphs, blocks of exposition where you explain something that is very detailed and reads like a dictionary, you're going to alienate lots of readers. Now, there are going to be some people like myself and perhaps like you that we love the crunchy world building, all the specifics, we're into that. But, you know, the average reader, they want to read a story about characters or about a problem or about a point, an argument that they can relate to or that they think is important. And then you kind of sneak in the world building. You sneak in, like, here's another proper noun, a place or a concept or kind of magic you haven't seen yet, and, you know, slowly introducing that. So, you know, that's the philosophy that I try to act by. I don't know if I actually achieve it, but that's the sentiment I had in mind when writing my books. Slowly seed world building.
You know,
and be careful to make when you make rules, you should just stand by them.
I like what you said, you know, a world building can be dangerous. It's interesting you said that because, and this is why I love talking to authors and being an author. I can remember going to an author workshop one time and a young man had wrote a book and it was it was kind of a sci-fi in the near future. And so it was interesting because, he started out, like you just said, he started out with, there's going to be this war. And I mean, you know, it was written really good, you know, it was written, but, you know, people in the group were like, oh, I can't believe that would ever happen. I mean, it just took them way off of, you know, the workshop itself because they got caught in that one, you know, that one part in the book. So it was, you know, interesting that you said that you can't give people something huge to digest in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to give them a little bit of time.
It becomes unwieldy.
So I do like that. Yeah, most definitely, most definitely. So talk about your characters. How did you, you know, how did you develop your characters and, you know, in the book? And the question I like, your character is modeled off of anybody you know.
Yeah, good questions. My impression, this is one of the fastest ways to alienate myself from other authors. So, you know, I did not come up with my characters first. I came up with a problem, a societal issue in my world that created tension between different kinds of people, a crux where different sets of a population would have different interests, just like in our own world. Anything that's political, anything that society sort of gloms a hold of and has like an us versus them type mentality, normally organized around an issue where it isn't cut and dry, where there are different arguments and different perspectives that based on the exact same set of observations, different subsets of the population could reach different conclusions. And so I thought, okay, I want to try to mimic that in my world and try to come up with a small number of major issues facing this world. And then I want to create characters with lives, with families, with friends, with virtues, with vices, and with weaknesses that we can all empathize with. And then, and then I want to say, like, for each of these major issues, I want to make sure that I have a character who has things that you could love about them or hate about them, and probably both, that reside on either sides of an issue. And so then, you know, I have five POVs in, across the whole series. And so I try to coax a reader into seeing one of these issues from one perspective, from one character, and then to flip it over at some point and see it from another character's perspective. And I try to lull you at first, like trying to make these issues cut and dry in this world. And then later on, I try to basically give you whiplash and say, actually, here's a totally different perspective that makes this issue suddenly much more vague. And it's those vagaries that create tension in societies and create both the problems in our world and conflicts that we see at a grand scale. So making it personal, making it about characters, but those characters were designed to bring the reader to personalized perspectives on two sides of an issue so that we still reach this grand scale, these major issues, but we do it from the perspective of individual people, or characters in this case.
And so you say that we're all villains in someone's life, and if we don't think we are, we're being naive. Is that really what you think?
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
I'm trying to think of who's villain.
Oh, man. I mean, like, if you cut somebody off in traffic today, at least for a minute in time, you were somebody's villain, believe me. If you're
tricking
into a hotel,
if you
come in at 8 o'clock after a traffic jam to a hotel and you're out of town, and you're the first one in the long line of people who need to check in, and your confirmation number isn't working, you're everyone's enemy then. So you're holding up the line. You know, I think it's part of human psychology. We need villains. And if we don't have villains, we're going to make one up based on very imperfect information. And so I think if you stand for anything at all, you're going to become someone's villain for just a little while. And invariably, people like causes. You're going to identify with something. You're going to begin to become a proponent of that. You're going to become an advocate of something. And as soon as you do, there are other people, possibly your neighbors, and they might not even tell you, for whom you will now be the villain. Like, my child versus your child at a recital. Like, now we're memoirs of the geisha. We're to be rivals. So, you know, like, there's that element. But I also think we all have a dark side, right? Like, you know, I mean, at least I, you know, and just to be clear, I have a very well-developed dark side that I don't, I'm not clapping my hands and celebrating it, but I also, you know, I'm mindful of that aspect. You know, I'm not a Mormon Eagle Scout. And so I have flaws in my character and weaknesses. And so I think that's not uncommon. And, you know, if you give anyone, I think if you give many people a lot of power and subjective power over others, and you just let a little bit of selfishness into that scheme, a line of power and even just a little bit of selfishness, and you can turn almost any saint into a villain in just a small amount of time. And pretty soon they won't be able to find where the edge of the forest ever was, and they'll be a gibbering lunatic villain of the cartoon variety.
You're giving me a whole new way of looking at villains.
That's right. Just give them a lot of power. Yep. No HR and a lot of power.
Okay. In the book, when I first, I don't want to tell everybody, but anyway, I was, you kind of start out reading about Chessa and seem to really, you know, you don't really give it away, and then you're like shocked when you start reading a little bit more. And I was like, so now I get the whole thing about, and, you know, and it's interesting because when you explain it like you do that, you know, you could be someone's villain. You know, me and my granddaughter, we like to watch a lot of the reality shows because we like to point out all the villains. Or we'll say, they're really nice, but there's something there behind that, you know. So that's a, that's a good explanation you gave. So we'll be looking at that a whole new way now. So tell me a little bit about your own redemption story. What did you, you know, what were the attributes that you have to be able to bridge your past life with your new one as a writer?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it sounds so funny to say, I'm the world's most evil spider biologist. Like, wow. Like, you know, and by the way, if you had told the 9-year-old version of me that, Jonathan, one day you're going to become the world's most evil spider biologist, the 9-year-old version of me would have been so excited. And, you know, the 37-year-old version of me who's talking to you right now, I'm not as excited about it. It sounds neat to say, but, you know, it's not as exciting as you might imagine. You know, I was a spider biologist, and I'd fly all over the world studying weird spiders in the tropics. And a few years ago, they discovered data anomalies in several of my works that appeared like they might have been manipulation. And, you know, like, oh, my God, the media destroyed me. And there were tons of stories based on a small number of perspectives that made me look villainous in a severe way. Well, it turned out in the end that, like, actually, these anomalies only changed, like, 1% or 2% of the data. It never changed any of the results, or I shouldn't say that. In almost all instances, it didn't change the results. And most of the studies that attempted to replicate my studies found the same results. But by the time all that got established internally, and by the way, I couldn't speak at all to the outside world for like 3 years, you know, that version of me was gone, destroyed. And, you know, just because I wasn't guilty of what they thought I was to begin with, doesn't mean that I got, I mean, you don't get into the situation I was in because of all your good decisions. So, like, you know, I still had messed things up badly enough that it caused a bunch of problems. And, you know, I got paid damages and signed NDAs, and then I moved on to the next chapter of my life. And while all this was happening, I thought, oh, my God, I have nothing to do with my life. I have no direction. Where am I going to go? All of my friends and my favorite pastime, my career, they're all tied to this giant scandal. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? And, you know, and thankfully writing these fantasy novels had always been on the back burner. Like, you know, like when I was a child, I thought, oh, and I'm going to write a fantasy novel, or I'm going to write a fantasy novel series, a trilogy. And, you know, the life happened in the meantime, and I had a job and a family and had parents that were sick, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you have to, real life can get in the way of those fairy tale goals for yourself. And then finally, when I was immersed in scandal and loss, frankly, lots of bad things were happening. I was losing a lot of who I was as a person. This other goal allowed me an outlet to have a new sense of purpose. So, you know, like, even though everyone in the world was concerned that, you know, I didn't think I was going to be able to move forward with my old career at all. And in the end, I got paid not to go forward and just to move on in my merry way. But, you know, that was uncertain at the time, and I was just overwhelmed. And these fantasy novels gave me something, frankly, to do. They were, I mean, I didn't write them like a therapy blog, like I'm journaling, but, you know, they were therapeutic in the sense they gave me something to work on and to pour myself into when other things were not going well. And, you know, and I think, I don't think I'm alone. Everybody needs to have a sense of purpose. And maybe your sense of purpose is being a really good mom or, you know, a responsible member of the PTA, or maybe you're going to be the best soccer coach in the world, or maybe you're going to start painting and you're going to teach classes at the YMCA. Whatever you're going to do, for me, you know, when I saw the first identity that I had, my first perspective of what I was going to do with my life, compromised, I am so thankful that I had another set of goals and that could use my existing skill set. You know, I've been a writer my whole life, and including my last career. So I was able to use those skills and repurpose them for another set of goals that were complementary. And so, you know, if you ever find yourself in that circumstance, and we're all going to experience loss at some point in our lives, and big aspects of loss, when that happens to you, I just recommend that you try to take an inventory of what is completely lost, what's been damaged by your circumstances but isn't lost entirely, and try to tell yourself what it would take to restore those skills or assets. And then there will be some things that are intact, aspects of who you are, skills, loves, et cetera, strengths. And you should take inventory of those too. And then you'll find, I think if people are careful, they'll see that not everything is lost and that there will be major goals, milestones that they've wanted to accomplish that they can still make progress towards. You know, life can be very broken, but it's rarely irretrievably broken. It usually has something intact, and if you can focus on what's intact, you can regrow. And I'm happy to say that was something that these books helped enable for myself.
You know, that's really, really great what you just said about, you know, everything you went through and then having that you know, redemption. Part of our theme this year in our media is about the art of resiliency. I've talked to a lot of different people from different walks of life and listening to things that they've gone through and how they turned that into something good. And so listening to you, it's like, oh, wow. And I will say that looking at what you have to be able to rebuild is, I think for a lot of people, it's hard to do because you're still kind of in that, oh, I lost, you know, I lost everything. I don't, you know, what do I have? And I think that's really great that you were able to describe it in the way you did. So tell me, like, they say that, it says that, you know, you fall over yourself to help repair people when you see people in pain. How do you do that?
Oh, I mean, I don't have children, and I took care of my parents before they passed. But, you know, I don't have kids, and because I've been lucky in my life that I've had a lot of joy and a lot of prosperity in many ways, and I'm lucky to have that. But, you know, I think most people, and perhaps it's not true, but I think that this is true, most of us need something to care for and love. And, you know, for some people that if they're on reality television shows, that might become themselves. But for most of us, it's going to be our kids or our partners or our loved ones or our parents or, you know, the kids in our classroom or whatever. And for me, you know, I love broken people, not because they make me feel good about myself, but because I feel like you can be closer to them. And people who are imperiled, people who are, who have experienced loss, people who are struggling, those are much more rewarding friendships for me to have because I feel like I can do good with them. Like I can actually, I can leverage my quality as a human being, my capacity to care and love in a way that isn't wasted and that is also appreciated. And oftentimes these people have incredible perspectives to provide to me as well. And so it becomes it's not charity. It becomes a mutualism. Like we both end up ministering to each other usually in the end. Like I think honestly, I think that's what a good friendship is. You're ministering to each other. That's what I basically seek in my friendships. And you know, having loss of the kind I had, basically if I tell people about that immediately and throw all of my skeletons from my closet onto the floor before them, most people respond with grace. And it basically gives them an opportunity to tell me and be honest about the things that they're frightened about or uncertain about. And that's a great jumping off point for a quality friendship. So I think I love helping people and being honest with them. But also, you know, when you do that, the people you're helping oftentimes become therapeutic and almost like therapists for you as well. So it becomes a mutualism.
Right.
And I think that's where the best long-lasting friendships will find a home.
And that is quality friendships. I think the most important part of that would be that you feel that you're in a safe place with your friends. So a safe enough place that you can say anything to your friend, you know. And, you know, I someone said to me the other day, they're like, oh, you're not ready for this. I'm like, I'm the most ready person you know. It doesn't scare me for you to say anything to me, you know. I said, I'm ready, you know. But, you know, I think that is a, you know, quality, you know, friendship. I'm always amazed when people call me and they'll say, oh, remember when you said so-and-so and I'm doing so-and-so? And I'm like, when did I say that? But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's something so deep and it's like, when did I say that? You know, was I drunk when I said that or what? But anyway, it helps people. You said your book, when I was reading the first part, is dedicated to loss, but what is your next book dedicated to?
I think it's going to be to opportunity. So, you know, I mean, I have to be careful because if I start doing this for 5 books, I better come up with an interesting noun. There was a moment, you know, when I was writing this book that, you know, loss helped me begin to improve my relationships with my family, and to restore those relationships before their passing, And, you know, that it was a silver lining that I'm grateful for. And, you know, having lost and having seen my, having had my life on the trajectory that I was on pause, that enabled me to move towards other goals, like writing these books. Opportunity, I think, is, I think it's going to be something like opportunity. And this is being workshopped, so please don't hold me to this.
Okay.
Something like opportunity is a shy but ever but present member at most parties, or something like that.
Okay.
Opportunity is everywhere, and you know,
it is.
Basically, you have to either be looking for it, and oftentimes when you're hurting, linked to loss, you're more likely to be searching for an escape, for an opportunity, for an opportunity to reinvent yourself. If you always keep an ear to the ground and one eye open, I think that opportunity is in most places, and if you're careful, you can find opportunities that are great for you that don't come at the cost to others. So, you know, something that helps both you and the people around you. I think if you've got your wits about you and you're looking for it, opportunity never goes away. And I mean opportunity for personal growth, professional growth, for growth in your family, spiritual growth, et cetera. I think you just... it's always there, and if you keep your eye towards opportunity, then the other bumps along the road, the turbulence that's unavoidable, it just sort of becomes the background noise that it needs to be, and you can stop clinging to yourself.
Uh-huh. Oh, I like that. I like that. So, you know, tell me what the type of things really help you with inspiration and research. Do you like to travel? Do you read a lot?
Yeah, everything is inspiration. When you've got a problem in front of you, I think everything, when I've got a problem in my plot that I'm trying to work out, everything that I do that day becomes something that I reflect upon in the context and the problem in front of me. So, you know, I have catty and funny friends that I can hang out with after 5:30, and when I do that, you know, they have great dialogue, and sometimes, you know, half the you know, like 90% of the dialogue that I skim from them and adjust naturally, it never gets used. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they give me this zinger that works so well in the context of this argument that's happening in the book, or this lecture this villain is doing, or this inspirational moment that this hero is having when they're reflecting on their circumstances. You know, everything in life can become inspiration for literature, for writing, and you know, and fiction is no exception. You know, the fiction I write is basically an AI amalgamation, you know, run by my brain, all my experiences, who I interact with, what I've gone through, the books that I've read, and that becomes a more powerful AI, except for, you know, it's not artificial, it's actually my brain, and all of our brains. It's a more powerful AI if we read broadly, interact with lots of people, consider lots of perspectives, and then also keep your hearts and minds open. And I think that's the way that you fuel at least impactful writing, and the kind of writing that we can all be proud of, not just for ourselves when we write it, but like humanity in general.
So was there a message that you wanted you wanted your target audience to get out of the Amber Lanier?
Yeah, you know, after all that sort of like gooey, gushy, like sweet, Boo, sort of romantic things that I think are wholeheartedly all true. It's funny. The lesson I want you to get out of it is so cynical. But it's only the first book. There are going to be five, so I can start off with cynicism. The good feels will happen later. Anyway, so the first book is basically, you know, be careful of letting any one philosophy, any one set of perspectives take over all the others. Even a beautiful philosophy that you think is like a set of arguments, that you think like these things are the most pure, that makes the most sense, and if we just instill this small set of values into the whole population, everything will be perfect. We'll have a utopia. Careful, because I think almost any philosophy, careful. So, like, I think any philosophy, if it doesn't have checks and balances, if it doesn't have the ability for others to dissent and have differing views. If one philosophy goes to fixation and prevents others from establishing or taking root, I think that any philosophy, even the sweetest, most kind-hearted notions, can become warped and eventually cause pain and cause great evils in society. So my bad guys, bad people, gals, whoever, in my books, they might be evil, they do reprehensible things, but that's not because they like to twirl their mustache and tie people to trains so they can get run over. They're acting based on sound philosophies that at face value sound admirable, but just because you're operating towards a set of goals that are admirable doesn't mean that the place that's going to take you or society is going to be the kind of world you want to live in.
Kind of a perfect example that came to my head when you were talking about how even the most beautiful, you know, philosophy or logic or motivation can become awful was the story of Frankenstein. Something that started out as a wonderful ideal to maybe help the world became just an awful thing. And I think we get a lot of examples of that today. I mean, you know, what we call it when we're watching someone talk, and, you know, my cousin will say, oh, they walked over to the dark side. I believe that. Yeah. I think that you get so caught up in your, you know, philosophy, just exactly what you say, that you don't, your blinders are on, and you walk into that. Not knowing at first, but I think that in a way you just kind of look at it as, I'm still walking among the flowers. But you don't see that the flowers
for you. Yeah, the flowers, the flowers are in bloom for you, but everyone else is allergic to it, so heads up.
Right. So why do you suggest slowing down if your house is on fire?
Oh, yeah, panic. You know, I don't. Mm-hmm. I think very few good decisions happen when you're panicked. When your house is on fire, like when everything is falling apart all around you, be careful. Like, you know, slow down. Do not move. If you can afford not to have to make a decision immediately, slow down and give serious decisions, especially when you're imperiled or you're losing something. Give it some thought. Sleep on it. Spend a week on it. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you have high blood sugar and low blood sugar when you think about a problem. Because, you know, your perspective might change. especially when a lot is at stake, if there are other people involved, you might be encouraged to move swiftly or to make a decision today. And I think that's likely to harm you. Two, anybody that's telling you there's no time, you have to do it now, that sounds like a sales pitch to me. And if people do that, begin to think, okay, maybe they're right, but before I accept what they're saying, think about whether or not they have any interests that could benefit from you making a wrong decision. And oftentimes you'll find that people who are telling you that we're in a rush, you're in danger right now, we have to move today, have to go, have to do it, have to do it right now, they're usually in sales. And they have a commission based on whether or not you ink that contract. So give yourself time. And even if it's a small amount, do not act today, do not send that email now, send that email tomorrow after lunch, after you've hung out with your friends for an hour, and you might find that the problem in front of you takes on a different morphology, structure, and how important it is to you might become might change. It become more important or less, and you're very likely to rewrite that email in a way that is more political and probably more accurate.
Okay. All right. So. A question I like to ask all writers, whether they're new writers or seasoned writers, is what would your advice be for writers or creatives or dreamers? What would your advice be from the experience that you have right now?
It is okay to write crappy chapters, crappy paragraphs, crappy dialogue, and to have a bunch of plot holes in your book. For a first draft. In fact, that might happen for many, many, many drafts. Most, I mean, the Amber Manier must have had 12 substantial, I mean, I shouldn't say substantial, 12 rounds of major editing. Major editing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the second one, The Eggs Inside, that I'm still editing right now, will come out next August. I'm sorry, this coming mm-hmm. August, so 2024. You know, I'm still editing that. There are chapters that work mm-hmm. beautifully. There are chapters that I'm like, either, you know, this is still needs work, and I'm still working on it, and you have to just accept that that's so. Do not let the goal of perfection stand in the way of making progress. Each time that you make progress, mm-hmm. you're moving closer to perfection, and you'll have less distance to go once you've got something to work with. It's easier to pick through vomit and turn it into something beautiful than it is to try to write something perfect on the first go. I don't know for whom they can write a perfect scene or a perfect chapter or a perfect book on the first go, but it isn't me, and I don't think it's most mortals, so I don't think it's healthy to try to prescribe that to people. So, you know, that's mm-hmm. true, but then also secondarily, if something's not working, even after many, many attempts, change it. You know, there are chapters that I've looked at and I think, you know, this chapter, I've conducted major invasive surgery on it, and it is still not very good. and you think like, okay, like, the writing is good. It's all technically correct. Interesting things are happening, but it's dead. It's flat. It's, you know, it's kind of ho-hum. And it's 14 pages that a reader has to wade through. And what is it accomplishing? Mm-hmm. So, you know, even at late stages, I think, should I just get rid of this whole thing? And if I did, what mm-hmm. am I losing? And if I'm losing mm-hmm. anything, can I just tuck it in somewhere else and save readers a few pages? Because, you know, a bad chapter can have people close a book. And if you have several bad chapters in a row, you know, it's very, I mean, you're testing the patience of your readers. If you have millions and millions of readers, you can have several crappy books, and people will wade their way through them until you return to form. For most of us, we don't have cult followings, and so, you know, don't take the reader's interest for granted, and do not become tied to something mm-hmm. just because you put a lot of effort into it. So when you're done with a chapter, when you're done with mm-hmm. a scene, whatever, or even a character, everything needs to be on the chopping block into the last few stages, because, you know, you can really improve a story just by making it more streamlined. The most ugly Christmas trees, the solution is taking off a small number of ornaments.
Right. Okay, right. You're right about that. Well, I like what you said about, sometimes you write a chapter and it's just like, I think one of the things that I see some writers, like usually someone will introduce me to a book, and if I, you know, read the first book and I like it, then a lot of times I'll read the rest of their book. But I have, mm-hmm. you know, started out reading some books that have been just amazing just in the beginning, and then at the end they'll have another book, and I don't know if it's to continue the story or if they were like, oh, let's try to, you know, add another story here, or if it was the money or whatever the motivation was. But then the last book turns out to be flat, you know, and you're kind of like, okay, not giving you the same excitement when you started reading it. So definitely, I wonder if some writers, you know, tell themselves that, okay, this is not really, you know, going where I want it to go, and I'm just going to stop here, or I'm not going to do it, or if they just, you know, keep going. But I do like your advice about just let it go.
It's not good,
let it go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's not good, you. I mean, I want to cut some people a break a little bit, because, like, you know, when we are, at least for me, when I'm reading a new story, I'm most thrilled by the things I don't yet know. So, like, I don't know who the bad mm-hmm. guy is, or I don't know who killed this person, or I don't know why this, you know, where the heiress to this bloodline went. You know, there are mysteries that need to be solved. And I don't mm-hmm. know what those are, and I'm thrilled by that. The conclusion is mm-hmm. oftentimes the mystery gets solved. And, you know, that can be satisfying, like, mm-hmm. I figured it out, or whatever. But, like, the end of epic fantasies is oftentimes sort of flat. Like, you know, the Wheel of Time, 14, mm-hmm. I think it's like 13 to 14, enormous books, and there's a prequel, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and I love that series. But, you know, first of all, there are big 1,000-page books in the middle of it that I'm like, this book probably didn't need to exist. But, you know, even at the end, even at the end of it, and I thought that they did a pretty good job ending that series, the last book, just after so much time with those characters, after so much expectation, it's hard to make anything feel special.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like the end is oftentimes a letdown. So, like, I'm not going to cut them a blank check, but I'm going to say it's not surprising to me that structurally people are more inclined to think that the final book or the final few books are, like, not as exciting as the first one. Because the first one, there's so much that's unknown and so much that's still possible in that world and for that story. And then the number of things that are possible get fewer and fewer until the last word of the last book, and the number of possibilities are pretty few. Sharing your little words.
Right. I was reading some of the reviews for the book. I mean, how do you feel when you're reading some of the reviews that people have written for the Amber Lemire? How does it make you
good.
Feel as a writer?
Yeah, you know, good. I mean, like, you know, honestly, people can disparage the book, or they, I mean, I'm happy to say that the average person likes the book. And, you know, also, people who are being critical, they, when they critique it, you know, they don't say things that are shocking to me. I can often, even the harshest critics, as long as they say something, I oftentimes can agree with what they have to say, and I can grow from that. But, you know, I'm just thankful in a society where, you know, not everybody's a reader. And I think it shows, like, first of all, I'm just happy somebody read the thing. And not just read my book, but read anything.
Right.
I'm like, yay. Like, good for you.
Yeah.
Keep reading.
Yeah.
I don't care if they lit me up and they disparage every book they ever read. God bless them for reading.
Mm-hmm.
But,
right.
You know, I do feel a little bit connected and less isolated as an author when I get to see reviews and when I get to interact with readers. And I like that. You know, I think I like that it's, on general, it's landed with people. They can find it humorous, they can find it interesting, and they weren't put off by my weirdness when I speak. And, you know, I have a weird way of speaking and a weird way of writing. So, you know, like, it makes me feel good that, I, you know, like, what I thought was funny is appreciated by others in some instances. Happy that the book has gone okay. Like, you know, there's a chance that everyone's going to hate it. We now know that that is not true.
Right.
Now the boogeyman for me is that after the first book goes well, that the second book is hated. So the sophomore effort turns out to be a turd. And now in August, I will be trying to make sure that that is not so, and that the second book is as good or possibly better than the first.
Right. Good. So, what's next for you? Do you have any events coming up? We know you're writing on the series for the Amber Lemire. So, what else is going on?
Let's see. So, you know, like, every single week there's, you know, a podcast or a news article or something that'll come out about the Amber Lemire. I'm writing the eggs. The next two books are The Eggs Inside, and that's.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to come out, at least allegedly. We'll see. I think it will turn out to be true. It comes out in August of 2024. And that, you know, the end of the first book, The Amber Lemire, sees the school that's the focus of the first book, The Amber Lemire, is damaged by the events that happened in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the school's hurt. There's a major catastrophe. And the second book describes a scenario where the other schools are so concerned about the Amber Lemire that they send scholars to come help that Amber Lemire while it's hurt, after it stumbled. And, you know, those other schools, they have competing interests with the Amber Lemire, and they might not want to see it recover. And so the people who have shown up under the auspices of here to help you might not be here to help you after all. And so a game of cat and mouse between the various schools ensues, and our heroes are caught between a political power play that now consumes the entire continent. So, like, you know, like most sequels, even if it's a horror movie, you have to kill more people, you have to make the problems bigger, and, you know, and that's what you have to do. You have to up the ante. So, like, well, you know, the Amber Lemire is cool, and it was deliberately smaller in its scale in terms of the setting, so that we could expand out in subsequent books and help round out that world building. So that second book should come out in August 2024. I'm going through the audiobook right now, which is narrated by Sharamie Lee, who's a wonderful vocal actress. My God, and we're lucky that we landed her. So I'm going through like the fifth time of listening to that. She must hate me because I'm like, ooh, can you just, there's one word here, can you adjust this? Or this pause is a bit too long on the word. So there's a reason that it's a month and a half late, and it's me. So that should come out soon. And all the people who are on my listserv will receive a free copy of that. I'll also post it on YouTube. So the first four chapters, you can go listen to it. If reading's not your thing and you're stuck in the car on a long drive for Christmas to go see the relatives, or New Year's, then you can listen to the first four chapters and see if this is your shtick.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I tell you, I like reading because, you know, I'm the person that likes to, you know, curl up, turn everything off and read a good book. And thank goodness that because my granddaughters are such, you know, a 7-year-old that edits their own videos.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh my God, and it's dangerous.
They're on the, you know, so they're doing all that. But I love it when they know how to put down their electronics and go pick up a book. That is so fantastic for me to see that. She will go buy books at book fairs and stuff like that, and I really love that. So, you know, we're still a reading family. But I do love when I'm working and I don't want to listen to any music, I will listen to an audiobook. And I do love that.
Yeah.
Just to kind of, see what's going on. Don't want to miss nothing. So, but I'd rather read a book than to, just have the TV going or something like that. So, yes, most definitely I will be looking for that book from you, for the audio book, so I can listen to that. My last question for you is, there's been a comparison between your writing and Ayn Rand. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, like, let's just have a moment. Ayn Rand. Like, I don't know of very many writers who are more hated than Ayn Rand. Good God. And by the way, I'm saying her name wrong. You're supposed to, because she made up her first name and she abbreviated her last name. Ayn Rand. I've grown up my whole life saying it wrong.
Okay.
So, yeah. Like line, it's Ayn Rand. Like, but you know, like also, whatever.
Right.
It's Ayn Rand for me. So fun. So sorry, Anne. So,
Am
I an objectivist? The major criticism of her is that she wrote these books that were a vehicle for a philosophy that basically said, like, the best way to move society forward is for everybody to do what's best for them. Extreme capitalism, animal rights, human rights, doing things for God or your fellow man, all of that will eventually be demonized and will hurt society. You need to do what's best for you, and the best ideas will come out on top. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, is that the philosophy that I'm proposing? No. But have I created a dystopia where I'm deliberately satirizing elements of our own world to try to, you know, think about what are the major issues affecting our world, and why do those things come about, and what are the solutions, and are there competing philosophies that I think we should consider? Yeah, I think that like Ayn Rand or Ayn Rand, I'm trying to use my books as a personal exploration of some issues in society, and also try to encourage the reader to think about it as well. So, are we advocating the same kind of philosophy, Ms. Rand and I? No, but are we both trying to use fiction to say things that are very true and very literal about our own world, possibly that will get someone upset?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And, you know, I don't think that, although, you know, I don't think Ayn Rand was, she knew she was controversial. I'm happy to be controversial too. So, you know, I'm not going to say whether it's a fair comparison, but I'm flattered by it.
Okay. All right. Well, I've enjoyed having you on here, Jonathan, and I definitely hope that, you know, when you finish your books that you'll think of us to come back talk to us about your new book. And I just want to tell the audience out there please go look at Jonathan's website because it really is an awesome website, and I should know because I'm a website snob. That's what my friends call me. I'm a website snob. And I'm just now beginning to accept that into my life.
We're all snobs on something.
Well, Jonathan's website is theshadowofthemonolith.com. And definitely we'll put that on our website so you'll be able to go straight to Jonathan's website and check out his website. It's really a nice website, Jonathan. I really like it.
Thank you.
I really like it.
Yeah, it's a great landing pad. We'll have updates from my blog and links there to buy all my various paraphernalia, my bibliographic paraphernalia. but my musings and developments for the world will be posted there, and I'll try not to bore folks too much. And I'm pleased with how that website turned out. So I'm glad someone likes it.
Oh yeah, I love it. Yeah, this is a great website. So, and I always say a great website, you know, people will go through it. And, well, at least I do. I look through it and I look at all the pages. And, you know, of course, I give my reviews. A lot of my friends come to me and they'll say, well, what do you think of my website? And I'm like, please don't ask me that. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
I'm like, just let it go and just say, yeah, you got a website.
You got a website, sweet pea. That's a big deal.
Yeah, there you go.
Love it.
Well, Jonathan, I appreciate you. And like I said, I know my audience does. And for everyone who's listening, I want you to know that I have a copy of Jonathan's book, and you know what to do if you want the copy of the book. Contact us in our email, and we will send you the copy. So I only have one copy, so hurry up and send me that email, someone. I know you want the copy of this book.
I'm glad. Yep.
And Jonathan, we will be... We'll be really rebroadcasting the program, after we do our editing, but we also will be putting it on our new syndicated radio program. So I will send you a email and let you know what those links are. So you can see if we did a good job. I think we did a good job today.
Oh, thank you. I always get nervous.
Yeah. Oh, you get nervous?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Did really good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You did good. But again, thank you for coming to Living Vertical Radio. Thank you for sharing your insights, and thank you for sharing, the journey of your book, and we really appreciate that. So we'll be looking for you again, and as I said, we'll be putting that out there to all of our listeners and our readers that weren't able to sit here and listen to this today. Great interview. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And this has been Living Vertical Radio, everybody. Thank you so much. And we will be posting this information later on today. Thank you.
Thank you to our faithful listeners. This has been Living Vertical Radio, and you have been listening to our host, C. Steen Duckworth. Stay tuned to our next program. Interested in getting your business in front of a worldwide audience? Contact info@verticalmediagroup.com. That's info@verticalmediagroup.com for details. And now, a word from our sponsors.
Books that make you laugh. Books that make you scream. Books that make you hope. And books that make you dream. What's on your bookshelf? Discover the books that make you who you are on booksthatmakeyou.com. Read book reviews. Meet the authors who pour their souls into the books you love. And enter to win bookish prizes. If you're a bibliophile, then Books That Make You is your new best friend. Visit booksthatmakeyou.com or find us on Insta and Facebook.
Hey there, it's Ellen Kay, and I want to know how you panda. I like to start with a chow mein base, a side of fried rice, then a corner of orange chicken, another corner of honey walnut shrimp, add your cream cheese rangoons and an egg roll or two, chopsticks, let's go. Panda Express has something for everyone. However you panda, get rewarded for it. Unlock surprise gifts and exclusive benefits, and all you have to do is download the app today. Get started at pandaexpress.com.
We all know a guy who only occasionally shaves for big occasions, and it's because that occasional shave really hurts. It's the time of year for big occasions, and yet there he is, suffering with that cheap drugstore razor. Let's help him out. Hudson Shaving's line of razors, built with aerospace precision, deliver a smooth shave your dad, brother, and even son can enjoy, eventually. With replacement blades just 10 cents each, you'll buy it once, and they'll use it for life. How's that for the perfect gift? Celebrate with 100 free blades on your first purchase, and no subscription headaches. HudsonShaving.com/holiday.